I'm Dr. Leif Tapanilla from the Idaho Museum of Natural History, and I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho, and this is The Nature of Idaho. Coming to you from the 1B, Bannock County that is, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Today's guests, we've got two. It's Daniel Ritz and Brian Brooks from the Idaho Wildlife Federation. Peter, we're going to be talking about maintaining and enjoying Idaho's wild spaces. I know you like being outside.
Oh, absolutely. I think you do too.
I love being outside. I think one of the great things in our state, specifically where we live here in Pocatello, it's so easy to get off the grid and enjoying all the cool things in nature.
Right. And I think with these guys today, with Daniel and Brian, we're going to learn that boots in the ground doesn't necessarily mean you're out in the muck and, you know, cleaning things up. I mean, boots on the ground happens at the state level as well. In Boise. And this is going to be great. These guys have put a lot of time and effort into keeping us wild. And it doesn't necessarily mean shovel and mortar.
We're going to dig into that. But first, nature news, Peter?
Right. You know, Leif, there's a surprising number of health benefits associated with tomatoes. And I'm going to chalk that all up to the antioxidants.
Antioxidants.
They're completely full of antioxidants. And tomatoes can help with your immune system, lowering your LDL, which is bad cholesterol. They may even help your eyes from the dreaded blue light syndrome of your
screens.
Screen times, right? Digital devices. They might help those that have asthma and may prevent emphysema.
What can't they do?
Yeah. Well, here's another one. They may even lessen your likelihood of stroke and may reduce gum disease like gingivitis.
Really?
Yeah. But you know what? Some researchers have found from the Cornell University that drinking tomato juice has another surprising health benefit.
Go on.
Yeah. It actually can kill Salmonella typhi.
What's that?
Well, back in the good old days, our good friend Typhoid Mary would have benefited from drinking tomato juice.
I didn't make the connection.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. So the researchers have found that drinking tomato juice can kill the bacteria that causes typhoid and many other types of similar bacteria. They've even isolated two antimicrobial peptides within tomatoes and tomato juice that are really effective in killing typhoid.
So this tomato juice can be in a Bloody Mary, for example?
Oh, totally.
Well, not that we needed more reasons to enjoy our tomatoes, but thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
No more typhoid.
No,
thanks.
Actually, we should be thanking tomatoes.
Thanks, tomatoes.
Yes, thank you, tomatoes.
Trivia question for today is squarely on topic. What year did Idaho's first voter initiative pass, which resulted in the formation of Idaho's Fish and Game Commission? What year was that? When we come back from the break, we're going to learn all about the Idaho Wildlife Federation and the great work it does. Stay tuned.
Get continued access to local news and all the programs you enjoy through the Listen Live link at KISU.org. Or try using your web-connected Amazon or Google smart speaker with the command Play KISU.
Hey, welcome back from the break. I want to welcome our guests today. We have two. It's a twofer. We have Daniel Ritz and we have Brian Brooks, both from the Idaho Wildlife Federation. So Daniel and Brian, why don't you each tell us a little bit about yourself and what it is that you do?
I'm the executive director of the Idaho Wildlife Federation and sort of manage all of our programs, the internal stuff to make sure that we are a functioning nonprofit and are continuing to advocate effectively for Idaho's wildlife resources, and that includes habitat, public lands, and access to them.
And I do communications and outreach. I'm largely the public-facing person that's sending out those emails that you get asking you to contact your senator or sending you fun updates on projects we've been working on. I manage our Conservation Ambassador Program and really work to connect our affiliate network. I'm a recovering journalist and aspiring writer and really like spend most of my time trying to translate the values of the Wildlife Federation to our following around the state.
You know, I think that's great. And being able to, in a sense, communicate to us as citizens of Idaho what you guys are doing and why it's important that the Idaho Wildlife Federation is in existence is a great way of really moving all of us into a direction that creates a long sustaining Idaho. So thank you guys.
Yeah, appreciate it. Speaking on the communications front, you know, we work really hard to sort of articulate what we see largely as shared values that are ecologically important, that are culturally important, that are historically relevant, not
just and often economically
often important. Economically yeah. important for a variety of different reasons. And so we work really hard to stay really committed to the sporting tradition of Idaho that has a lot of opportunity and channels for different people to engage with these wild places and wildlife.
The name of your group, Idaho Wildlife Federation, explain to me why it's a federation.
The definition of a federation is many voices from one. And so we bring together a network of affiliate organizations that have affiliated with IWF. And right now we have 28 affiliated organizations, and they're really sort of broad in their values and interests in wildlife and conservation. For instance, you know, we have some species specific affiliates, the Idaho Wild Sheep Foundation, the Turkey Federation, the Idaho Deer Alliance. And then we have some, like, you know, harvest specific groups like the Idaho Traditional Bow Hunters, the Idaho State Bow Hunters. Some of them are regional, like the Henry's Fork Wildlife Alliance
or North Idaho Flycasters.
North Idaho Flycasters. Yeah. So everybody who has a lot of these organizations, they have a stake in abundant and healthy fish or wildlife populations and access to them, and to make sure that we have healthy waters and habitats so that we have robust fish and wildlife populations.
And we're pretty upfront about acknowledging that while we have a lot to offer from our, we'll call it central down kind of articulating our experience and working with our affiliates and navigating the corridors of whether it be the state house or federal, you know, land management plans and things, it's invaluable the contributions of local folks on the ground that intensely know their space, you know, capital P places. And we very much are oriented on local solutions to local problems. You know, we are an exclusively state focused conservation group, the only full-time staff exclusively focused and that work in, and you mentioned the state house. You know, it's really important that we reach out and that we engage and that we really respect the input of that affiliate network. I, as the person that works with communicating with a lot of those folks on a regular basis, it's really foundational to why IWF is as strong as we are and the role that we play in this complex conservation space. And there are a ton of partners.
Yeah, so we bring them all together and we speak with a unified voice is essentially the idea of this, of a federation.
So my first thought with the federation is you have all these voices, you know, how do you bring all these voices together and how do you find, in a sense, compromise to pursue legislation and together
and focus.
Yeah. Right. Cause you've got so many different voices. And as you're talking about all the different organizations you're working with, you know, I'm looking at some of the conversations we've had with, you know, people who use our public lands and not for hunting or fishing, but for enjoyment, whether it's paragliding, rock climbing, you know, all kinds of, you've got all these voices.
Yeah. I'll take a stab at that one. There are some times where our affiliates may disagree with each other, but you'd be shocked. By and large, we agree with each other like 98% of the time, because it's, some of these things are so foundational and crossover. I mean, if you're interested in upland bird habitat, for instance, you know, we have the High Country Desert group that supports like pointing dogs, and they're out of Buell. They really mostly care about rangeland issues and upland bird habitat and the existence, like, you know, sage grouse, sharp tail grouse and stuff like that. But, you know, what do they have in common with North Idaho Flycasters? They need access to public lands. They need healthy habitat, but it's sort of this like camaraderie. It's like, well, we want to support what you support, even if there's no relation to us. But where there is that separation, where it might be too far, you know, they mostly will just say like, well, we'll support you generally. But if there's an issue X, if it impacts, you know, let's just say it's big game, we're going to contact all of our affiliates that are interested in big game. That includes not only the species specific group, but obviously the traditional bow hunters, the state bow hunters, those kinds of folks. And we'll talk to like maybe it's like one third or one half of our affiliates are really only interested in that. So we'll bring them together, talk about this issue, where we see the policy or environmental implications of some issue, whether it's a piece of legislation or a management decision by a public land agency or a state agency. And we'll try to figure out where the common ground is, and we will advocate for that. Very seldom do we get groups saying, I do not agree with what you think, and I will like put my foot down and prevent us from moving forward. And if that ever would occur, a group may just kind of like give the compromise or say this is just not tangentially connected enough to our mission and kind of just step aside and let the groups go forward. So you'd be shocked at how much agreement there is on these issues. In fact, I think when there has been a disagreement, we usually just let the affiliates work it out with the agency themselves, and the Federation will not take a stance. But that has been like, I can think of one instance in my 8 years.
And I think like I 100% agree with everything you said. And I think that really points to the issues that IWF is focused on working on. Mm. You know, I work a lot with like the people on the ground, you know, and I like, it's commonly received that like conservation is looking at things like regulations and rule setting, and like at the end of the day they are super important, but they're the end of the road. Where most of our affiliate network and where sportsmen as a whole, again, not always, but generally agree, are on those foundational issues that are long-term thinking. These are investments in the protection of wild spaces from, you know, encroaching development. These are setting a precedent for an independent commission. These are more kind of foundational, big picture policy issues, which sometimes, you know, we don't get the headline. We want fish to be there, period.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that sort of speaks to where most people are behind that. There's not too many folks in our network that are really fighting, you know, that far into the weeds.
Mm-hmm. Right. It sounds like that speaks to the alignment of the members within the Federation of their values, right? And if the core values are maintained, right, and there's a strong overlap in where people's values are coming from, then on any particular issue, you're going to find a lot of alignment and a lot of a similar way of thinking, right?
Yeah, and our affiliates are, before they join IWF, there's sort of some ground rules. Like, we're not going to advocate for, like, here are the goalposts on what we work on. Here, we have to be backed up by science. It has, you know, there's a number of things that, like, really guide our what we engage on and how we engage on it. And so everyone is pretty much on board with that from the get-go.
So in terms of accessibility, what are some of the challenges that you guys are seeing within the state right now? Or is access generally pretty strong?
You know, yes, 62% of Idaho is public land. And that is like, I view it as a blessing and it's a gift. And and so that means that there's a lot of places to access. The challenge I see that comes from that is, you know, what types of user groups and stakeholders want a piece of that pie. So a lot of the work we do, we sit on many like forest collaboratives or rangeland collaboratives, and those are processes sometimes officially recognized or sort of just run by the nonprofits, and we try to work with the agencies to influence management outcomes. But those bring together environmentalists, water users, ag interests, timber interests, mining interests, and here we are representing wildlife, and people want to pursue wildlife, and that's oftentimes hunters and anglers as well. And so the challenge really is hearing people and listening and figuring out how we can balance the uses that and all the resources that are found on these public lands. It's access isn't actually so much of the issue. It's more about how do we share that with others, and how do you define access? And let's just say, let's narrow in on just recreationists, and that includes, you know, people who want to get out into the landscape and hunters and anglers. Some people view access as being able to take your four-wheeler everywhere you want to go. Others believe it's, you know, access is good enough as primitive access, which we talk about capital W wilderness, where there's no mechanized use. You can go in with horses. Many people fall into the all of the above category. How do you balance like the different landscapes? And so you look at the unique characteristics. For instance, you know, we supported and ran with the kind of campaign of supporting the Boulder White Clouds initiative, which resulted in the passage of legislation, which designated it as wilderness, that landscape, because people by and large wanted to protect that. There's lots of threats. it means that we're not going to mine the base of Castle Peak, but clearly that is not access to the mining company that wanted to mine it. So I think really the challenge isn't a lack of access. It's how we balance it with everybody else.
You know, I think about when we look at public lands, who are the shareholders for Idaho's public land? Every single citizen of Idaho. And they, especially everyone who wants to use and enjoys using public lands, they have a voice in this. And so as we expand out and look at the big picture, what you guys are focused in on, it's that idea of if we're in the agricultural end of it, they're concerned about water issues and water rights. But when we look at the anglers, they're also concerned about water. And both parties need happy, healthy water. Bringing them all together and taking the approach that everyone's a shareholder, I think you guys are spot on in how you move forward with these organizations and your work within the state.
Appreciate that. And I think something that a personal point of pride for me, just to add to this conversation, is that we are often advocating on behalf of and elevating voices that are coming from those still connected landscapes. And these are the Salmon River breaks. These are speaking from communities there, and really spending a majority of our time investing into attaining those relationships and connecting and serving people from those landscapes and the wildlife in those landscapes so that they are represented with the proper value in comparison to, like, respectfully, things like agriculture and development and all of the things that are top of mind for folks. But yet there is real value, like we said, cultural and economic, and the work needs to be done. And it's often harder to bring those to the same table. And so I think that's the something that I'm a real point of pride for us, to like really bring those to the table to make sure that the folks in Riggins are speaking about returning our salmon and steelhead, you know, the folks on in the Clearwater Valley or from Buell, or having their voices heard at the same tables.
I think in order to make solutions sustainable, you have to really involve the local folks who are going to be impacted by whatever decisions will change resource management. And we engage our affiliates and our grassroots network, and even folks who don't belong to IWF early and often, to try to gauge, you know, what is the right way to manage a resource or a landscape.
When we look at well-being of fish and wildlife, for example, is the approach there largely centered on habitat, or is it more specific? You know, how granular, how focused on different organisms does the Federation get, or is it more larger scale in habitat protection?
It's all over the place. It's often macro, but it can be micro as well. You know, we work on some specific issues, for instance, with wild sheep. Their habitat's important, and it's mostly a lack of abundant nutritional native forage. So, of course, there's a habitat component, and how do we get resources to federal agencies to kind of reseed and make better habitat? But it's also a disease issue driven mostly by a disease called MOVI, which is a disease carried by domestic sheep. And so there is an interface there, and there's a real headbutting that happens, no pun intended, between bighorn sheep and domestic sheep. And obviously, you know, we have to work with domestic sheep grazers to figure out a way to get domestic sheep out of bighorn sheep critical habitat. So that can be very granular and very specific. That's one example. But sometimes it's just higher level, you know, when we're talking about just preserving unfragmented habitat, that can be just like mobilizing people to continuously show support in instances specifically to our state legislature, that there is support for public lands just generally. That is just it doesn't even matter what the reason is. We just deliver social support for just keeping public lands in public hands. So that's a very broad level. But yeah, sometimes it does get pretty granular.
We all love to fish. Very few people know what makes up a blue ribbon trout stream. We don't just work with Idaho Fish and Game, for example, for like the biological fish health. You know, you have to look at the quantity and the quality of the physical habitat. You have to look at the chemical quality of the water that's there. Like, it's like a three-legged stool, I've kind of used the metaphor of. Oftentimes people think that it starts and ends with the physical population health. And that is a ton of our work. But you can pretty easily see through that, like, it, the finger, like, it extends very quickly out into things that touch and impact, like the chemical quality of the water or the habitat, mm-hmm. or whether, you know, the amount of habitat that there is, you know, all these things are interrelated. So I think that's kind of a metaphor that I've used to share, like, sure, sometimes it's huge macro issues, and sometimes it is in the very, very, very minutia, but they're all connected and they all are equally important. So
it's also quite interdisciplinary. In order to get a blue ribbon trout stream, that involves working with the local grazing association and understanding grazing rotations and fencing and different restoration sciences and why and how do we implement water flows released from dams to mimic, you know, the spring pulsing of like scouring the rocks so there's not siltation. So there's bugs to eat and they can lay eggs and there's natural production. And so it's when you start advocating for a wildlife resource or a fish resource, you start to understand that there's connections to the economy, other industries, and it's helpful. And in my opinion, it's imperative to understand the other industries involved so that you can actually, you're not seen as like a litigant person, or you're here to blow them up or stop what they're doing altogether. If you want to fix something very small, it really blooms fast into all these other facets and aspects.
See, I think sometimes we get stuck in the micro, especially when we look at the environment and the habitat. You can always start with the micro, but it always leads to the macro. And you guys are doing that. So we're going to do this lovely transition, Leif. Let's move to what you guys are working on with the legislation and the big picture of your work.
Yeah. Every spring, we are heavily active. Brian is our ED, is our registered lobbyist. And I'm kind of reigniting my fire of being a reporter, and I call it driving the desk season, where I'm working, you know, kind of reporting on the activity out of the state house. And we are not advocating or campaigning for, but we do track our mission statement and how that's going through the legislative process.
But we can't campaign for individuals
We're really looking out for what the pieces of legislation that do impact, that are adjacent to our mission statement specifically. So there are those within the legislature that we are tuned into every year, and we're educating and informing our constituency. And then there's also this encroachment upon that independent fish and game commission. And we're starting to see a creep towards similar to surrounding states like California and Washington and Oregon, to the dismay of sportsmen for the most part, and encroaching an action by the legislature in place of our established Fish and Game Commission process. While we have a couple of good bills that we are standing behind and working on a lot of our time this year, we have just recently, as of this week, started really diving into the conceptual objection of the injection of legislators acting on their own behalf as individuals in place of and often against our independent Fish and Game Commission. And I'll let you kind of dive in more on that.
Yeah, the commission was formed to make science-based management, biological response management to fish and wildlife, and taking it out of the hands of legislators who are not often informed, or scientists themselves or experts on this issue. And we've seen a trend in recent years, the Idaho legislature making changes to season setting or trying to harvest of different animals. We saw this with wolves a few years ago. Just a couple of years ago, they made some changes to archery equipment that we can use, sort of increasing the technology. And of course, our argument was, well, one, this is going to make a more successful harvest rate, which means we're going to have to reduce the season length or tag distribution of animals. This year, there's a bill that would increase the technology allowed for use on muzzle loaders, essentially turning a 90-yard range weapon into a 300-plus-yard range weapon, essentially turning it into a rifle. And, you know, these are political decisions made by legislators, whereas for a long time, the commission has kept those things at bay because Idaho, by and large, we'd like to be an opportunity state, issue more tags, even if that means you're going to be less successful. So what Daniel's kind of summarizing was just that we've seen legislators taking more and more of a dive into making minute changes to how we hunt or how we manage populations. And there are unintended consequences, which we try to let them know about, but it's really tough. And that swings both ways, you know, in places that can be also a ballot box sort of initiative, like the restoration of the reintroduction of wolves into Colorado. Regular voters also, like legislators, are not informed on science and unintended consequences of reintroducing species and support or don't support that issue. Our point is really like, should we really be putting the power in the hands of politicians or the average voter to make these pretty important ecological decisions? And in our view, it really shouldn't. And so we've seen that erosion over the last few years in the state legislature, unfortunately, and that continues this year. So we are working to kind of stop some of those bills. We have two of them right now that are sort of mandating some changes to hunting seasons and fish and game management that we don't really like.
Something that you and I have talked about a couple of times in the last couple of days that I just want to point out that I think is really important, because I didn't prioritize it enough, is this concept, this North American model of wildlife conservation and this independent fish and game, like the system that we have rolling and have had for decades. I work with our affiliates, I work with our sportsmen contingent to make sure that they know that when their season setting process is coming up, when they can contribute to their own well-being, they get to the tunes of tens of thousands of people on those consecutive scheduled kind of procedural kind of events. They get that engagement opportunity and they can contribute. And then it goes through best practices, it goes through analysis by staff, it goes through the commission. All of a sudden, when you take that out and you're making these decisions in this unrelated, totally new space, you may have one day for a decision to be made in a committee and then during business hours. And it's really turning a back on the sporting community. I think that's really pivotal for people to know. Sure, you can watch on the internet, but these are doors that are being closed that have for decades been actively supported by the sporting community. You were just sharing earlier, the bill that is being considered, the changes for muzzleloaders this year, a number of those, not all of them, but a number of those changes were considered during the rules.
They were scoped
during the rules setting procedure this past spring.
Through the commission process.
Commission process. And correct me if I'm wrong, but you said only 9% of like sporting commentary that came back was in support of those changes. Yeah. 91%
opposed.
Yeah. Yet here we are.
And so a legislator didn't like that. And so Fish and Game Commission decided, well, we're going to go with the 91% here and not allow these changes. And a legislator just said, well, I want these. And I was just going around. And when it results in increased animals taken off the mountain, there will be a resulting biological response of fishing game having to shorten the season or issue less tags. And so it's just it's a bummer.
But they all connect again, right?
Yeah.
Like it's the notion of thinking about the unintended consequences of one person's action or a group of people's decision-making on one thing in the natural world will have repercussions that affect that natural world and our, humans' way of interacting with it, right? And so I think, being deliberate about that process and being open about that process seems to be rather important.
Yeah. And the commission like model, if you will, the North American model of wildlife conservation, it's not perfect. There are small tweaks we can make here and there, but by and large, we have a very successful track record of recovering species in this country. The North American model is, the example, and there's some tenets to that. You can't market wildlife. It's a user pays model. We've brought some species back from the brink, like turkey, which it's funny because Pocatello has a turkey issue right now.
We do.
And of course, we should also acknowledge that one third of America's wildlife species are also headed towards endangerment. And so the North American model works for the species it works for. There's some other components we need for the non-game species. But all of these processes about how we manage our game and how we take public input, going through that commission process, by and large, has worked. When we go through the political route, that's when things really start to spiral out of control.
I really want to thank you for the work that you guys are doing. We need you to help us out with our trivia question, though. What year did Idaho's first voter initiative pass that formed Idaho's Fish and Game Commission?
1938.
What was the name of that bill?
It was just the Citizens Initiative of 1938.
Thank you, Brian and Daniel, for joining us today. If you love what Idaho has to offer, especially with our wild, please go over to idahowildlife.org and see what you guys are up to.
The Nature of Idaho receives support from listener contributions to KISU-FM. Music is by Idaho's very own Sons of Bannock. Audio of this and all past episodes of The Nature of Idaho can be found at KISU.org. Send your thoughts and suggestions to noidkisu@isu.edu.